You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 165. And with me this evening, it's April the 10th, 2011. I have Margaret Harding, Dan Yerman, Gwyneth Cravens, and Steve Applin may join us if he can get his microphone situation sorted out. Unfortunately, he can hear us but can't talk. So how are you all tonight?
Great. This is Margaret. Great to be here. Wonderful weather here in Wilmington today.
I hope you're not being sarcastic.
Oh, I got a sunburn on the beach.
Very good.
I'm hoping not to have to do any appearances. Well, actually, I tried to keep my face from getting burned, so I didn't look like a complete Rudolph with burned nose.
Dan, how's life in Cleveland?
This is Dan Yerman. I blog at Idaho Samizdat, now transferred to Ohio, been here a year. Still not going to change the name of the blog, though.
Good.
And Gwyneth, are you back in New York, or are you still on the east, on the West Coast?
I'm on Long Island. I'm back on the East Coast. And my name is Gwyneth Cravens, and my website is cravenspowertosavetheworld.com.
And Gwyneth is the author of the book that all of us love to cite. She is a former anti-nuke converted over and one of a growing group of those people. I count, let's see, Stuart Brand, Patrick Moore, Mark Linus, George Monbiot. Who else is on that list of former anti-nukes, of people who actually actively opposed our technology?
Stephen Tyndale, who was the head of Greenpeace in UK.
Ah, yeah, I forgot about him. Very good. All right, the initial topic for this evening is what I call, and what Steve Applin, who hopefully he'll be able to join us, called on a recent post, nuclear exceptionalism, which is, and the question that Steve asked is, why is the possibility of injury from a radioactivity from a nuclear power plant somehow more important than the reality of injuries and deaths from many other energy sources and from Mother Nature itself? So what do you all think about this nuclear exceptionalism idea?
Well, I think one of the reasons that nuclear exceptionalism exists is because other forms of energy enter consumer markets. You have gas in your home. Coal is something you can feel, touch. Some people actually had coal-fired boilers. Oil is something that people have had because they put gasoline in their cars. Nuclear energy does not touch consumer markets. Because it doesn't touch consumer markets, it's considered exceptional.
That's a fairly standard theory. Margaret, have you got any thoughts?
It's an interesting question. I think that part of it, at least the way I've looked at it, is that there was this mantra in the 50s and 60s, when a lot of the people who were vehemently anti-nuke were children, there was the air raid drills and the atomic drills and the fear of radiation. And you think about it, there's the Godzilla movie syndrome. You know, the whole Godzilla premise was that the radiation from Hiroshima and Nagasaki turned an ordinary lizard into this evil monster. And there just was a myth that grew up because it's a great evil scientist story because radiation is invisible and it's all around you and it's impossible to control. And so there's this mythology that has developed that I think is really in the psyche of a lot of people, that it's just so dangerous that there's it's just too unsafe for words.
You know, it's interesting. One of the email lists that I subscribe to introduced the idea that was introduced to him by a former commissioner of the NRC, and he was told that in reality there are three different colors of gamma rays. There's the green gamma rays, which are all around us and from natural sources like potassium-40, and then there's the purple gamma rays, which are and we don't worry about the green gamma rays. And the purple gamma rays are sort of useful, and people see them because they're used in medical treatments, and we regulate those a little bit, but we're not too concerned about those gamma rays. And the gamma rays that we are terribly concerned about are the red gamma rays. Those are the ones that come from nuclear power plants. And anything that was produced in a nuclear power plant is somehow extremely scary and something that we have to really worry about. And that's something that I've seen, you know, since the earthquake and tsunami at Fukushima, is that, you know, a lot of the scary messages of radiation has been detected, you read the levels and you find out it's way below what, you know, is considered to be normal background radiation, and certainly the variations of normal background radiation.
But you have to read all the way to the end of the article for that to be mentioned, as a rule.
And I got to, you know,
comparison up front.
Right. But I got to say, TEPCO's way of reporting this, and I'm not blaming TEPCO. TEPCO is, they don't have time to squirrel around with a lot of this stuff right now. They're trying to get their jobs done. But the problem is the way they report, they give you raw numbers, nothing in context. So it's really easy for people to blow that just completely out of proportion. And you have to go find somebody else to help you understand what that really meant.
And I agree with that. But, you know, one of the things that does bother me about when some people try to translate the raw numbers into, you know, something that makes sense to people, is that then they often get rid of the raw number. And I equate it to the old how many homes does a power plant provide power to notion. That measurement frustrates me because it varies depending on who you read, and I hate units of change.
Me too.
So, you know, when somebody says they this is equivalent to a CT scan, what CT scan? Which, I mean, there's a whole variety of diagnostics that are done with a CT machine, and I think each of them have different actual doses, and, you know, I'm...
Well, it depends on the scan you're doing, too. It's very dependent on the specific scan being done.
Right. And that's what I mean, is it depends on what you're actually trying to locate in a human body and which scan you run as to how much the dose rate is. And there's a lot of variation there. So, you know, that measurement doesn't make much sense to me. And sometimes I get frustrated with people who won't learn the units. And of course, we don't make it any easier because the units are pretty darn confusing when you start talking about rems and sieverts and grays and
becquerel
and becquerels and curies and picocuries. Yeah, you
know, I think, Rod, you have to keep in mind the efforts to bring the metric system to the United States have failed utterly. If you can't get that far, I don't think you're going to make much progress with radiation measurements.
Yeah,
there's another point I would like to add, because I'm probably the only person online here who came from an English major background and did not join the Navy.
Nice.
Or anything like
nice.
It. Or, I had one science course in college, and that was biology. So I thought all that time, all until I met Rip Anderson and he started explaining stuff to me, I thought there was man-made radiation, which was utterly deadly. And I knew about cosmic rays and things like that from seeing our friend the Atom and movies like that when I was a kid. So there was good, there was perfectly normal natural radiation, and then there was the evil kind that came out of nuclear plants and could travel infinitely long distances to come into my apartment, or, you know, from Three Mile Island or from Chernobyl. So I think, and I considered myself to be, you know, I'm a college graduate. You know, I thought I, like, knew something here. I didn't. I didn't have a clue. And it was a long time of talking to Rip before he understood it, how ignorant I really was, and how at what an elementary level he needed to start talking to me on.
Well, you make a very good point. One of the things that the logical connection that many people don't seem to make is that radiation or radioactive materials don't have some sort of special propellant that makes them more likely than any other kinds of gases or water-soluble materials to travel around the world. They travel on exactly the same air currents as all other contaminants that get thrown up into the atmosphere. The difference with radiation or radioactive materials is that we can detect them at such tiny concentrations with relatively simple machinery, you know, where we can't detect the mercury that comes out of the Chinese coal plants as well. But certainly if, you know, iodine-131 from Japan can make it to Idaho, the mercury that comes out of a Chinese coal plant is going to make it to the U.S. as well.
And is, on a daily basis.
It's just harder to measure. And also doesn't carry a signature with it. You know, iodine-131 is a pretty unique isotope that doesn't, you know, appear naturally and doesn't last all that long once it does appear. So if you find it, you can pretty much trace where it came from.
Well, a question I have, Rod, is the nuclear industry for years has done education, outreach, published articles, op-eds, done as much as any other energy fuel source like gas or coal or oil to try and educate the public. Why hasn't it taken?
Well, one of the things the nuclear industry hasn't done that the other industries have done is the nuclear industry's purchased very few advertisements.
And in reality, the educational courses we taught were very isolated. They were one-off deals in classrooms if you had a teacher who was sympathetic. And a great fraction of the population actually never got those courses because they were taught around the power plants. So the kids in the classroom were already probably more prone to be supportive because their parents may or may not work in or know someone who worked at the power plant.
Right. And we've done the teacher workshops and whatnot at ANS. Under ANS sponsorship, but if you look at the numbers of science teachers in the United States versus the number of science teachers that have attended an ANS teacher workshop, you know, we're not reaching a very large portion of the population. And I really believe that the idea that the nuclear industry has not purchased advertising that runs on a regular basis, you know, as frequently as an Exxon put a tiger in your tank advertisement, or the coal industry's you know, nice little commercials with people plugging into a lump of coal and those kinds of things.
The lumps of coal singing Christmas carols is pretty nice too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we can get our Atom singing, man.
But but advertising has two purposes. I'll let my cynicism come out. One of the purposes of advertising is to regularly share your message, unfiltered, you know, obviously in short bites, acceptable bites to people. They may not pay attention the first time or the second time or the third time, but it's amazing how many times somebody will say, well, I heard this, and you find out the only real source they had was an advertisement. Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful natural gas ad on every night on around the news time, news hour time. Mm-hmm. And it's just all about how the the school bus is powered by natural gas, and we helped you barbecue your ribs, and we kept the school warm and the hospital running. You know, it's all this feel good stuff about your friend natural gas. You don't hear that from the nuclear industry. And there's one other thing about nuclear people I've known when I was growing up. They didn't talk about anything, partly because Albuquerque was a bomb-making
secret
city and secret. But that secrecy kind of took hold. I mean, Rip Anderson is a good example of someone who worked at Sandia. And yes, he did secret work, but he also did openly known work about working on getting the waste isolation pilot plant open. I socialized with him and his wife for years. I had no idea he was leading this huge project and doing fascinating things like getting futurists and social scientists and stuff together to think about what the world would be like in 10,000 years. He never opened his mouth about what he did. And when we began talking, I said, well, why didn't you tell me this stuff? And he said, I could tell you were anti-nuclear. I made it a point a long time ago not to tell people that I had anything to do with anything nuclear.
I did that, too.
If you met him at a party or if he was your neighbor or something. And I think a lot of people are like Rip. They get abused for saying they're nuclear. Whoa. And they, and I now see the look in people's eye when they say, oh, what is your book about? And you can see this sort of look that is something like, oh, I thought you were a nice person. I was wrong.
Do they pull back from you as if you're contaminated?
Well, I've had that experience. On airplanes. When I used to work for the cleanup program at the Idaho lab, I was on a plane one day. I'm sitting in the aisle seat. Guy's sitting in the middle seat. Says, what do you do? I said, well, I clean up nuclear waste. And he jumps and it heads towards the window. You know, we're 30,000 feet.
I think Steve's on.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Steve. You're there.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Hey. Yeah, I poked around. Hey, how are you guys doing? Interesting conversation.
Hey,
so,
Steve,
so I got to tell it. Go ahead.
And you started it, Steve, because I read your excellent blog post on Canadian nuclear. What is it? Canadian energy issues, right?
Yeah.
And talked about nuclear exceptionalism.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of talking about something that hasn't even happened yet, and other stuff has happened, and it doesn't get any play. Two people died in the earthquake the other day. You know, 7.1. That 7.1 earthquake.
Uh huh.
Two more people died in that than have died because of radiation at Fukushima.
But it's just not nearly as exciting. Come on.
It's not as exciting.
Does anyone have hard facts on how many deaths were caused by the oil refinery explosion?
I have nothing. I've looked all over for that.
You cannot find a word.
Somebody must have died because I don't know if you saw the footage. It's pretty spectacular.
I'm assuming that since I can't find a single report of anybody dying, that the oil industry has figured out how to operate a refinery without a single person. that's my assumption, right? I must be wrong, though.
Or they have a fabulous department that controls what's on Google and PR.
Well, they did the Disney trick, and they made sure none of the bodies were actually left on the site.
Well, there's no doubt that the oil and gas and coal industry has a much stronger response effort when something bad happens.
That's because they get more practice at it.
Well, true.
They're just better funded. They're the New York Yankees when it comes to this stuff.
Look, they get more accidents than we do. We don't do this very often, so we're not very good at it.
Well,
the assumption is, there are a lot of nuclear accidents. They're just covered up.
Oh, I know. I've heard that.
And these anti-nuclear sites love to list all the stuff that you could find on the NRC about,
the near miss stuff.
The ladies' restroom sink was clogged, or, you know, whatever. It's Oconee Nuclear Plant. And, you know, kind of all these things that don't really have to do with reactors, but just show you how many accidents and failures there are.
You know what the latest
one was that amazed me? It just happened, I think it was yesterday or the day before. Apparently, at the Pacific Northwest plant. What's the name of that one? Columbia?
Columbia Station.
Columbia Station.
Okay, so there was
used to be called Whoops.
There were some people that I guess they broke into a line, and there was a little bit of hydrogen left in the line, and literally had a flame roughly equivalent to lighting your propane grill in your backyard. They evacuated the plant. 25 people left the area.
There you go. That was brilliant.
They reported it as a
hydrogen explosion.
An unusual incident or something like that. It just boggled my mind. And part of it is, like you say, Margaret, since we don't have very much practice, we really do tend to overreact.
We're Keystone Cops. We overreact. Well, and we're trained to do that. And that's a good thing in terms of not letting an incident get out of control. It's a bad thing in that we run to the worst case scenario all the time. It's like this NRC document that got leaked last week. When you really read it, at least when I read it, and what I told a number of reporters when I finally got a look at it was, that's another story.
Right.
Was it looked to me like they were taking the little amount of data they had and postulating the worst case scenario, and then thinking about mitigating or preventing that from happening and making recommendations about what they should do, which is a good idea in terms of safety. Mm-hmm. It's a really terrible idea in terms of trying to communicate to the public what you think's going to happen or what they should be watching for.
Right. Well, I watched the hearing where Virgilio was trying to explain to Congress why he thought it was a good thing, and I agree with him, that they have a system in place where regulators who have questions are free to ask those questions and free to poke holes in other people's assumptions, where people like Markey was trying to portray it as, well, there were regulators that just didn't agree with the assumptions being made, and so that means they were right. And I spent an awful lot of time doing what-if drills.
Yeah, but see, Markey doesn't have anybody ask him questions. He never doubts anything. So it's easy to cast aspersions on people who have doubt. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just amazes me.
Well, the whole idea, I even have I never really pursued it very much, but I do have a blog where I've got the domain questioningattitude.com registered, because to me that was one of the most important things I learned, was to always have a questioning attitude, to never accept, well, that's the way it's always been, as a reason for anything.
I did that to my staff once. But that's, it's both sides of that coin. Is I like to use that same questioning attitude in reverse. When somebody says, for example, got into a discussion that the cores had to have melted through the bottoms of those vessels and had to be eating through the concrete. And my answer was, why do you say that? What evidence do you have that makes you say that?
Other than the China syndrome.
Other than having watched a 30-year-old movie and gotten confused again. And there was this long silence, and it's like, well, just because it could have. That's not what I asked. What evidence do you have?
Well, the news media, I think, wants the excitement of a disaster movie.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of interviews with a radio talk show host in Toronto who kept asking me, what is the worst case scenario and has it happened yet?
Who is this?
This woman on AM talk radio in Toronto. I don't remember.
Not CBC. Radio. So who would that be? AM 640.
AM 640. I'll have to look it up. Anyway, the point is that she, in both interviews, which were 2 days apart, she asked me the same question. On the second time, I told her what the worst case scenario would be. And there's like dead silence at the other end. And she says, well, has that happened? And I said, no, none of this has happened. And I said, it's unlikely to happen as long as the reactor pressure vessels and the primary containment are intact, and they are. And by the way, Nuclear Energy Institute has published data this morning from Japan, from the Japanese Nuclear Safety Agency, which shows temperature data, pressure data.
Oh, I love that.
And a whole bunch of other parameters, measurements, how much of the fuel was uncovered and so forth, from the 16th of March to the present day. This is the information, that guy presents in a spreadsheet with graphs. It's beautiful, and I really encourage you to take a look at the NEI blog, NEI Nuclear Notes. It's the lead blog post on Sunday.
This is the thing that you just tweeted about a little while ago, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
And there are Excel spreadsheets with the data in tabular form. So if you want to go and look and see cool. all this stuff,
it sounds
it's
like the
there.
Work of David Bradish.
Dave Bradish did it.
Yep.
Hat tip to Dave. It's done by, I looked up the guy who did it, done by a guy named David Garcia, who is from France, from the French Nuclear Safety Agency. He was posted to Japan on a joint research project. And so he's there. And so, of course, he's familiar with all the data sources. So he assembles this stuff and puts it on the blog and says, by the way, guys, you know, here's all the data on the fuel for reactors 1, 2, and 3 in terms of how much they were really uncovered since the 16th of March to the present day.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's great data.
I have a question about what we're just now talking about, which is I have been saying to people, and I want to just make sure I'm not saying something wrong. Well, we did have a worst-case scenario at Three Mile Island. The reactor was deprived of coolant, and there was a partial core meltdown, and it was contained.
I think what you get into, Gwyneth, is that there's this debate about, well, but if we didn't add coolant back in and we just let it go, it would have been worse. So you could argue that until you run a core where you shut it off, drain all the water, and let it sit, you will not see a worst-case scenario. I argue that Three Mile Island and now Fukushima are really demonstrations of some of the worst-case realistic scenarios, but the true worst case scenario would be that somebody woke up one morning and said, you know what, I'm not going to put any more water in that reactor and just shut the pump off. That would be far worse than anything that's happened, because they've put water back into these guys and cooled them back down. Well, so that's why we engineers are a little reluctant to say worst case scenario. I argue worst realistic scenario, because no one's going to shut the water off and not turn it back on.
Well, you know, one of the things about Fukushima is we should be able to use that as a way to show what can happen when a whole bunch of things go wrong.
Yeah.
And because we have so many layers and we also have trained operators, you know, we have managed to bring it under reasonable control without causing a significant amount of harm to anyone. Now, obviously, I'm not terribly happy about the fact that we have had to evacuate a fairly significant area, and the evacuation out to the 20 kilometers was probably reasonable. Anything more than that wasn't, but. You know, we have, because of that, that's part of the procedure, right? Is if you need to, you move people out of the way.
Well, and that's always been one of my points, is this disaster, and I use that term only because the media has happened in slow motion, that gives you time to get people out of harm's way if anything does go further south.
Right, and that's part of the regulations, right? Is to reduce the probability of early release.
Right, so that you have time to react. And when you start to tell people that, they're kind of like, well, I hadn't thought about it that way. And, oh, by the way, the evacuations beyond 20 kilometers, we should all be clear that that is in large part humanitarian, not risk. The government has looked at the situation and said it is increasingly difficult to get food and water to these people they've asked to shelter in place from 20 to 30 kilometers. And they've said, look, if you want to leave, we'll help you get out of there.
Yep.
It is not, oh my God, it's worse, it's out of control, we need to do something. It's really more humanitarian.
Well, this raises the issue in my mind of what exactly was the basis for NRC Chairman Gregory Jasko's testimony to Congress a few days after the disaster, in which he called for a 50-mile evacuation for Americans. And the questions I raised on my blog was, who did he consult to get a technical basis for that recommendation. Did it come from the Emergency Operations Center at the NRC? Did it come from data that he got from TEPCO? Did it come from infrared satellite data that showed the temperatures of the reactors? Did it come from consulting with his counterparts at the Japanese Nuclear Safety Commission? What was the technical basis for that recommendation?
There have been people who have asked him personally that, or directly that question.
And how has he answered?
I don't know that he's given an answer that satisfied the questioner yet.
I suspect he's done the interview trick of answering the question he wanted to have asked and not the question that was asked.
It was an interesting thing that Cheryl Rofer mentioned last week about who's the other NRC commissioner, the guy with the Greek-sounding name, Apostolakis? Something that he has said at that Carnegie Endowment conference. That sounded pretty critical. That was some, you know, made in extreme ignorance and like that kind of stuff, and on extremely conservative assumptions that were not practical, that kind of thing. That seems to not have gotten much more out there.
Well, I just want to come back to this 50-mile thing because I think it has some significance that goes beyond the immediate crisis. Ed Markey, the congressman from Massachusetts, has been pushing.
And Jasko's former employer.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. Thank you, Ron. has pushed for a 50-mile limit, which would be completely impractical as far as any reactor operation is concerned. I don't know if he just pulled 50 miles out of the air, if it was because he remembered it from having talked to Markey, or if there was some other basis. And I'm not casting conspiracy theories here. But if I was the Japanese foreign office, I would look at Jasko's testimony and say, you know, this guy is interfering in the domestic affairs of a sovereign nation. We have a problem with this, and because basically what you've done is you've told the Japanese government, we don't think you're doing an adequate job of protecting your people, so we are going to take additional steps to protect ours. Great, thanks a lot.
Yes. Well, the 50-mile number, there's a couple of places that it occurs that I found interesting. One is if you read that new reg that I got back when all of that was breaking, New Reg 1353, is the study that was done in 1989 about spent fuel pools, which is where this all came from, right, was the spent fuel pool fires. Mm-hmm. And it did, as a part of it, the requirement in the U.S. is that they do a cost-benefit analysis on the risks that they assess and whether or not they need to demand that the utilities incorporate additional safety measures. And they have to look at the risk. And the way they did that in that report, and I found the number very interesting, is they looked at the risk for a 50-mile radius. And they said, if a pool full of fuel caught fire, what would be the potential increased risk of death for a 50-mile radius? And I just found that number really interesting.
Well, and remember that if I remember that study, they didn't just say that this pool caught on fire. They basically said that
they assumed it emptied all of its contents.
Right, the fire lofted the entire contents of the pool into the air.
It was a complete source term. It was 100% of the source term lofted, and looked at a 50-mile radius and said how many people would die, which was just an insane. Even with that, the study ends up saying it's still not a sufficient risk to go do anything. Now we. You know, I'm not going to get into the validity of the study, but I just found the fact that the study used a 50-mile radius, and Jasko talks about a 50-mile radius, and the way he has said it in the few comments that we've seen is it was based on a worst-case scenario study. And I go back and I look at that New Reg 1353, and I just wonder if that's not where that number came from.
I wonder, though, if there's a realistic appraisal based on what we know about population densities around U.S. cities, 50 miles makes any sense whatsoever. I just want to give an example by analogy about population densities from Vermont Yankee. Robert Hargraves, who many of you know, has been doing his classes on nuclear energy, and he did a energy substitution study for Vermont Yankee. What would you need in terms of numbers of cows per square mile to substitute the energy value of Vermont Yankee? And the answer comes out 632 cows per square mile for the entire state of Vermont. So I'm thinking, okay, that means you have to go out and get 632 cows, feed them, and recover their waste in order to make methane for every single square mile in the state of Vermont. And I said, well, that's a very interesting visual image about population densities related to energy value.
Right.
And I just can't get that image out of my head when every time Jasco says that we should go out to 50 miles.
Well, one of the effects of 50 miles would be to almost immediately shut down Indian Point. Because
I was just thinking, yes.
Because, again, you cannot evacuate. You cannot claim you can evacuate Manhattan. And Manhattan is within 50 miles of Indian Point. That was one of the reasons that...
Why do you think the number got picked?
That's exactly why I believe the number got picked. There is a very focused effort to right now get rid of Oyster Creek, Indian Point, Pilgrim, and Vermont Yankee. Seabrook is a little bit further out because Seabrook's license doesn't expire for another 20 years.
Oh, that's
well, Oyster Creek was renewed. Let's just be clear that Oyster Creek was renewed, and Exelon's made a deal with the state of New Jersey to shut it down 10 years before the expiration of its renewed license.
Yeah, but since Fukushima, there's been a renewed effort to get it shut down before that expiration.
Because where's that coming from?
In New Jersey. The same people that have been working to shut it down ever since it got close to being relicensed.
Well, has the governor endorsed that? I mean, the governor bought into this deal, which is why they wouldn't pursue the cooling tower issue for Oyster Creek, because they said they would shut it down in 10 years rather than keeping it open for 20.
No, the governor has not bought into it yet, but it's a very strong effort, again, because Oyster Creek is another BWR like Vermont Yankee and has an elevated fuel pool and, you know...
It's a Mark I containment.
It's a Mark I containment, so... You know, that there is a very organized and focused effort to make that happen.
Well, let's talk about the energy that Oyster Creek provides along with Salem and the Hope reactors in New Jersey. Basically, the nuclear reactors in New Jersey provide about 30% of the electricity for the entire state. New Jersey is one of the most densely populated states in the Union. It's among the top 10 in terms of total population. And you simply cannot pull 600 megawatts of power out of the grid and expect not to have problems with rates and supply. And I think the governor's well aware of that.
Well, there are many people disagree with me, but there are many folks that want electric rates to go up and want to sell more natural gas. And in matter of fact, quite honestly, there are people who are quoted as being nuclear industry advocates who would be very happy to see the natural gas prices go up, because that would make their 17 operating nuclear power plants far more cash lucrative.
Okay, well, talking about replacement power in New Jersey, if you look at the area, the nearest power station is on the other side of the Delaware. It's across the Delaware River. It's in Pennsylvania. It's an Exelon site, and it has a combination of both coal and natural gas plants. One of the coal units is supposed to come offline next year because of its age. Mm-hmm. And so clearly, if Exelon is going to replace Oyster Creek, it's going to have to build gas at that site and then run the power across to New Jersey. So that's one possibility. The other is that PSNG actually has begun to pursue an early site permit for another reactor over on the Delaware River at the Hope Salem site, because all the infrastructure is there. So I think there's some realism in New Jersey, which is not the case in New York. The governor of New York has continued to pursue an effort to close Indian Point, and he's been asked very bluntly, you know, where is the replacement power going to come from? And he's answered in a sort of cavalier way, I'm not concerned with that right now.
Well, apparently he wants to run a cable across the Hudson River to New Jersey. So it's a good thing New Jersey will be building more reactors to replace
like,
the power lost from shutting down Indian Point because it's on a fault.
Yeah, well, maybe
that's the other thing going
on. So he's taking a page from the Germans' book. The Germans shut them all down and import power from France. Works.
Gazprom, yeah.
Or Gazprom, yeah. I mean, they're getting nuclear from France. And what is it, Czechoslovakia is going to build?
The Temelin site in Czechoslovakia will be revived. It's 5-reactor proposal, $25 billion project. The Czechs would absolutely love for Germany to shut down their nukes because they'd be happy to build Temelin. And said, we have this colonial sort of approach to nuclear power. California is a good example. Power comes from Arizona, okay, and goes to California.
Coal-fired plants.
But also, there's a proposal to build a nuclear reactor in Utah and ship the power to California. They were going to build a coal-fired plant, independent power number 3, 900 megawatts in Utah. And the city of Los Angeles says, oh, no, we're pure.
We're not going to have more coal.
So now what have you got? You've got a bunch of GE guys coming out there and say, well, gee, okay, we'll build a nuclear power plant, you know, and they may get to do it. So in which case, California, maybe you should tell us a little more then when I get done babbling here. But the point is that California is got this colonial approach to nuclear power, and now New York's doing it. And Germany, of course, going to Temelin. That's another colonial issue. So you have this whole thing where people say, oh, we're pure, we're green, we're not going to have any nukes, but we're happy to buy the power across somebody else's border.
And they'll claim the credit for shutting the nuclear industry down in the state.
Right. And incidentally,
New Jersey is within a 50-mile radius of Manhattan. So
I love it. I love it.
Is it true that Michael Bloomberg is pro-Indian Point?
Yes, he is. Very.
Yeah.
And he's a more popular and powerful politician than – who's the governor? Andrew Cuomo, right?
Well, and Cuomo is –
Bloomberg is very practical and realistic. Cuomo and his father, their hobby is closing down Indian Point. And Dan and I were pursuing this, we got, at least I came away with the impression, I can't speak for Dan, that probably Cuomo's not going to actively try to shut down the plant. There's a big uproar right now with Riverkeeper, the archenemy of Indian Point, an environmental group. They've always wanted to put a natural gas plant where Indian Point is, a safe natural gas plant that wouldn't explode and kill people.
No. The chances of that happening are 1 in 100.
Well,
yeah. or 1 in 50. But hey,
or 1 in 50. But they're 1 in something.
But the chance of a magnitude 9 earthquake happening under Indian
on
Point,
the Hudson,
you know, that could happen at any moment.
And
with a tsunami from the Hudson River.
And if it happened and there were a natural gas plant there, I'm sure it wouldn't explode.
No.
And if it did, that's a price that we can pay, but we can't have a slow motion partial meltdown that doesn't kill anybody.
Oh, my God.
You have to understand that the people that sell gas are very rich and powerful, and they have done a very good job of being the establishment. You know, I have a video in my library of Robert F. Kennedy speaking to the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, and he is the founder of Riverkeepers, I believe.
Yeah.
Still their primary head guy.
He's their legal guy.
And he was talking to the Colorado Oil and Gas about how... Did somebody just disappear?
No, I'm here.
Okay.
We lost Margaret.
I think I lost somebody. But anyway, he was speaking to them and talking about how he has worked hard to increase their market to make it so they can sell more natural gas. And then he asked them for money.
Ah.
So,
Rod, you also have a video, if I remember correctly, of Carl Pope.
Yep.
Of the former head of the Sierra Club. Going around with an executive from a natural gas corporation talking about the wonders of natural gas. Am I correct in that memory?
Yep, you are.
Well, this is the problem that the Nuclear Energy Institute has in being an advocate for the industry, and that is because their member utilities also are gas utilities and coal utilities. And they don't like
being trashed.
so the problem is that if you push one fuel source, then another one, it's seen as zero sum. And this is a continuing problem for I think NEI in terms of its ability to be a stronger advocate, because its member utilities by their structure have multiple interests.
Yeah, but and so not just that, they're being outspent. They're being outspent in the general advertising. I heard Gwyneth earlier back when I was trying to figure out how to get on. Gwyneth was talking about those ads that are on. You're probably talking about CNN, right? CNN is this. Yeah. We're cooking the cube steaks, we're steaming the veggies, and making the coffee, and this, that,
warming the baby's bath.
That's every commercial that comes up in the morning is one of those commercials, and that's all through the day. That's day and night running on CNN. It's leading off PBS. PBS is Chevron, Human Energy, and let's get more renewables and all this stuff. This is just the nuclear industry does not have that kind of ad budget.
And the important thing about having a big ad budget is it's so much easier if you're a big advertiser to pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And call an editor and say, lay off, buddy. Quit yakking about my accident. We're fixing it. Get off our case.
We're fixing it, and we're your biggest account.
And if you don't stop, we're going to pull our money.
This area of shrinking advertising revenue. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's no doubt that's happening.
Well, you had that during the BP accident with CNN and BP. I remember watching Ali Belshi, their business reporter, on scene from Louisiana, saying, BP has a bit of a safety problem.
Oh my God!
And obviously, what he's doing, he's dancing around it because this is very early in the process because we didn't know the full scope of everything, because they're a huge advertiser on CNN, and the news media is terrified of for very good reason, I think, of offending major advertisers.
Well, this is why I think that. That's the reason that the nuclear industry has such a difficulty in the media, is we don't advertise, so they have no problem offending us. They have no problem beating on us because,
there's no consequences.
Exactly. The nuclear industry is not an advertiser, so they can beat on us all they want. And they do. How many times have you read an article about Fukushima where you have the first full page of the article is about the challenges that are facing the people working on stabilizing Fukushima, and then finally you get down to a paragraph that said it just says something like, and the death toll so far is 12,000, and it doesn't 12,000. Even say that it's from the earthquake.
Well, that thing I forget who it was that sent the CNN thing around today of the car driving into Fukushima, and they're talking about the horrific destruction. They're driving towards the nuclear plant. If I didn't know better, it was the nuclear plant that caused this destruction.
Yeah.
And they never – the guy had the radiation detector, but they never said whether he was detecting natural background radiation.
Yeah, it was just beeping.
I mean, it's just radiation there, and it's deadly, and it's serious, and it's gloomy and terrifying, and
There's got to be some way to leverage social media to make up for this gap in the amount of money that the relative industries are spending. I mean,
I think that is already happening to some extent. On Facebook, for example, there's a lot of pro-nuclear commentary I know that most of my friends are New York liberals or old hippies and things. And they're learning from, stuff I post that I get links from the social media and put them on my Facebook page and stuff. And they're actually learning that maybe it's not as bad as they might think. And so that's just a little example. It's a few people. But if other people, Dan and...
Yeah, this organic viral stuff could that might be the way that it happens.
Well, and these environmental guys like Mark Linus and so on and George Monbiot, who are that's all over Facebook. They're coming.
Yeah, that's
here.
Huge. That's
huge.
I think the other thing that's huge is the fact that like that listserv and just the social media, the fact that it allows the people that know something that aren't don't have their hair on fire to actually reach the mainstream media before it was too late. We didn't get 100% the way there, but the conversation was far more rational than it was after either Three Mile Island or Chernobyl.
Huge difference.
I think so.
And I think that's partly because we don't have a media that's three networks where they control the headlines. We don't have a media that's just, you know, the main daily newspaper and you got the editors controlling the headlines. We have people that can go out and search and find their own headlines and find information. You know, the readership of Atomic Insights went up by a factor of 10 during the first week or so after the accident. People, you know, the disaster. It is a disaster. It was a natural disaster.
Yeah.
It wasn't really an accident. I mean, it wasn't like there was an operator error or some machinery failure at the nuclear plant. It was a natural disaster that happened to have a nuclear plant in the way.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think is different that is partly the real-time communication is that it was a lot easier to discover the errors and point them out. So, for example, there was this hair on fire, radiation's going to hit the West Coast, it's going to be terrible, Hawaii better get ready, there's going to be the Aleutian Islands are going to get it, blah, 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 blah. And then it comes out that, well, yeah, we detected it, but scaring people to the point where they took iodine pills. God, took iodine pills, and they're going to make themselves sick for having done that. There is a terrible price to pay for that fear. Somebody's going to get held accountable. And there a lot of the media kind of backpedaled and started to say, well, maybe we screwed up when we did that.
Yes. I was surprised to see I was in California until just the other day, and so during the whole crisis practically, and I was surprised to see the local newspapers warning about not taking potassium iodide, especially if you might have a thyroid problem, a thyroid condition. It would be very unhealthy for you to do. The LA Times had a special, you know, box with in bold print talking about the reality about the exposure and how minimal it was.
Well,
and the Monterey Herald had to set, they sent up a jet from the air base in Sacramento with very high tech equipment to, you know, take a sample of the plume, and they found that the radioactivity was 1/1,000,000,000 higher than normal. And that so that was in the like our local paper where we were. So there. If I was out and about and seeing people, I would say, you know, please don't take potassium iodide. They would say, oh, no, I'm not bothering with that. So, and this is California. And this is the
thank God.
The land of the fruits and nuts.
They were really laid back about it. I mean, they were not.
They got more radiation going to the beach.
Yeah.
You know, I got a nice sunburn. I keep thinking, God, I got out in gamma rays again, you know?
Well, and
but those were green gamma rays.
Don't forget, I'm sorry. Yeah, don't forget.
My skin knew the difference.
That the burn on your skin is as dangerous
absolutely.
As the burn on the legs of those three workers that walked into the radiation water.
You know, I live in a part of the world where people get lots of sun. I mean, the southeast, get out there. And there's a much higher rate of skin cancer here because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And like my mom, bless her heart, we grew up in Iowa, but she was a gardener. She was out there all the time. She never bothered to put sunscreen on. And she's had numbers of precancerous cells taken off of her arms. She never goes to the beach. She's never been near a nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Her daughter, now I've walked through neutron beams. Okay. I'm an idiot.
Well, Jerry Cutler wouldn't say that you're an idiot, depending on what your dose was.
It wasn't a big deal. It was we were doing a lab test, and we had this little test reactor at Iowa State. It was a 100-watt reactor. It didn't scram. It flushed. I've told that story before. It was built by American Standards, so it makes sense. It didn't scram. It flushed. but this was back. It was built back in the 50s when everybody and their mother was experimenting with building nuclear reactors, including American Standard. Bizarre. anyway, they were doing a test, and they hadn't adequately roped off the area, and I just walked between the rabbit tube and the gamma, the neutron detector, and got myself zapped and freaked out the RA, and you know,
so they went it sounds crazy. Like it sounds like your reactor was about the same as the one at RPI that our friend in Vermont was the only reactor he ever qualified on.
Oh yeah, well if that's the one he ran, I got to say I'm not impressed.
It was 100. That was a 100 watt reactor as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it can't light a light bulb. I mean, you know, it couldn't even boil water. We flushed that puppy. You didn't have to put the control rods in because if you took the water out, it just kind of stopped. That's why it flushed. There was no need to scram that baby.
Well, getting back to Steve's point about social media, I think it's important to say where people went for information the first few days. As Rob was pointing out, the numbers just shot up. Another nuclear blog that I'm familiar with went from about 400 page views a day to 50,000 page views a day in the first few days after.
That was ANS Nuclear Cafe?
That's right.
NEI also was completely swamped.
NEI was getting a million hits a day is what I was...
Wow. Jeez, that's amazing.
The websites of the World Nuclear Association and the IAEA both crashed, and they had to run out and buy new servers in order to handle the load. People went to the source. They bypassed the media and went directly to people who had bona fide nuclear energy information.
Well, this is what they did. I think they went to Google. They said, okay, I'm not going to go to the New York Times. I'm not going to go to U.S. News World Report and blah, blah, blah. Go into Google and type the name, and if you've got your SEO set up right, you'll wind up there. That's amazing.
Yeah, TEPCO's website came up real quick on that kind of a thing. I live on the TEPCO press releases and the NISA press releases, IAEA, NEI. You know, I actually told Fox News I don't listen to the media. They talk to themselves.
Well, and they'll tell you that themselves.
Oh, well, you know, you guys have heard the story. A reporter who shall remain nameless told me he called me up in a tizzy, and that the unit 2 pool was boiling. And it was like, what? You know, it was some ungodly hour because it's Japan and I'm here. And I run up to my computer and I start digging around. I'm trying to look at dose rates. I'm trying to figure out what might be happening. I get an email from him 2 hours later saying, this is a classic case in bad journalism. It should be a case study at a journalism school. Because they took a bad translation of Japanese and AP ran with it as a wire story and everybody printed it. And it wasn't true.
But that will be used in the future by NIRS and other
absolutely
groups.
Yeah, they will
say,
cite the
covered
the
up
media. That's right.
But it, you know, that thing alone, that boiling reactor killed 10,000 people right there.
Oh yeah, and this particular reporter had to fight with his editors to keep it off the air because he wasn't sure it was real and he wanted to make sure it was right, and he fought to get it off the air. Fortunately, he was senior enough to win. So he didn't embarrass his network wasn't embarrassed by publishing a bad story.
I watched something on CNN that actually blew my mind. Nancy Grace, who's a kind of a screamer, got in a fight with a CNN weatherman. They broke for the weather, and we're flipping channels. And here's Nancy Grace, and we just happened to hit this at the right time. I don't watch Nancy Grace, okay? Just in case you were worried. and the weatherman is telling Nancy Grace, "You have nothing to worry about from radiation," and she says, "Oh yes, you do." And the weatherman went at it with her. This was completely unscripted
on right? CNN.
On CNN.
Holy mackerel!
Amen.
I wish I could have seen that.
There was another unscripted moment I saw on the Ed Schultz show on MSNBC, and he was reciting Harvey Wasserman's figures on the thousands of deaths from Three Mile Island and the horrible illnesses and so on. And Robert Bissell said, "You know, Ed, I don't want to get into an argument with you, but there were no deaths in Three Mile Island." And now I believe Margaret might have had something to do with that sort of response, and which is to me a miraculous thing because in the past, when I began writing the book and learning something about nuclear power and realizing how deluded I had been about it, and so when something when an article would come out in the paper that looked wrong to me, and I would run it by some nuclear people, experts I was talking to about nuclear matters. And they would say, no, that's not true, and so on. But there would never be a contradiction. No one from the NEI would run a contradiction or an op-ed or say, no, that really isn't the way it happened. That isn't a true characterization. And for years, the New York Times would run these squibs from overseas news, and whenever it referred to Chernobyl, it would always mention 100,000 deaths.
Yeah.
Millions, yeah.
And just as it was a given that a Chernobyl site of the 100,000 deaths that resulted from the explosion or whatever.
Yeah, that's one.
So
of
now you have people like Robert Bozell arguing with the guy quoting Harvey Wasserman. You have Matt Wald, who's really doing a good job. In the past, I sometimes despaired about what he was saying, and that he would always recur to these guys like Lyman and Lockbaum, but he's now broadening his, the people he checks in with, which is really refreshing.
Well, I also like the fact that he's mentioned several times that the Union of Concerned Scientists has been opposed to nuclear energy for a long time. I believe is the organization. He said that several times. But you know, along the same lines is George Monbiot's very public spat with Helen Caldicott. His debate on Democracy Now! Made a huge impression on him because she was rather irrational during that discussion, and he challenged her on the sources. And he's written up exactly what's happened on the communication between the two, and it's a fascinating observation. And he's quite disillusioned with the information that he's been fed over the years,
and that he bought into at first, and then he's realized that it's built on a bunch of she's citing herself, and she's citing newspaper articles.
Right.
Well, what's great about it? Yes, but what I loved most about his whole thing was he brought in the comparison of the climate deniers and saying you're doing exactly what we've complained about these climate deniers doing. And whether or not you believe in global warming, it's a great point. Is you don't get to say on one side these guys are irrational and non-scientific because they're ignoring the IPCC, and then turn around on the other side and say, but UNSCEAR is not believable either. I'm sorry, they're both UN organizations. They're both founded by a lot of very talented scientists. They both probably have problems with their data, but they're both trying their best to get it right.
And they both have reasonable points, too.
They both have reasonable points, and you don't get to throw either one out. If you accept one, my opinion, you got to accept the other. But then I'm sort of biased, so.
There's another a nuclear exceptionalism thing, which is we all know that computers have gotten smaller and faster, and digital technology has gotten sleeker, and each year it's going to be better and all of that. People assume nothing has happened in nuclear technology since the 1950s or something.
It's an old technology.
We have these old plants in the United States, but these plants are old, and I always say they've all been upgraded. They've been had every part of them replaced practically, and they're still they're more efficient than they've ever been. They're running at much higher capacity than they were 30 years ago. But there's this it's another sort of myth which I had engraved in my brain, which is nuclear plants for these old clunky decaying things, because that's how Greenpeace and other antis like to characterize them.
Well, part of it is because they're run by a bunch of Homer Simpsons who are obviously just protecting their jobs when they explain why they've chosen to be nukes. I'm sorry, I am being sarcastic. I want to make sure that people understand that.
Good thing you said that, Rod. I would have had no idea.
I have been accused of being a shill so many times, and people don't understand. I do work in the nuclear industry. I do accept a paycheck proudly that is my employer, but my job has nothing to do with selling and is certainly not the job of a shill. A shill is, when you get George Clooney to sell a car, You know, he didn't design the car. He had nothing to do with making it. But because people like to look at his face, you know, he can sell cars. You know, that's a shill. A paid spokesman is not what we are.
And I had a delightful interview with a guy from CNN this week who was doing a story on the future of nuclear. He wants to look out. It's a complicated thing. Mm-hmm. But he was trying to figure out who Margaret Harding was. This is always fun. You know, what's four-factor consulting and who's Margaret Harding? And I had the pleasure of one of the rare times I got to actually explain why I'm a nuke. Because that's how he asked the question. He says, well, why are you a nuke? Who's Margaret Harding? Why are you where you are today? So I actually got to go back in time and say, I am a nuclear engineer because I went to college right after two major oil crises. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for a technology that would get us off of oil.
Yeah,
and good. And that didn't put nitrous oxide in the air or sulfur dioxide in the air. At that time, carbon dioxide wasn't such a big concern. And I looked around and said, you know what? Nuclear was the only answer out there. And that's why I'm a nuclear engineer today.
And I have almost exactly the same story because you and I are about exactly the same age. So.
Exactly right. We figured that out last time.
And, you know, I tell people, and this is absolutely true, when I was a kid, one of the annual events that we had was my father worked for the power company, and we would go have a picnic. We loved going to the FPL picnic because they treated people very well. They always had, you know, all these huge bins full of roasted peanuts, and they had all kinds of games. But the picnic was in the shadow of the Cutler power plant with these very tall smokestacks. Now, Cutler wasn't running all the time, but every once in a while when we had the picnic, we would see the smoke belching out of the smokestacks. And then Dad told me, I guess I was about 8 years old, he told me about new plants that his company was building that didn't even need smokestacks down at Turkey Point. And, you know, I had numerous conversations with Dad about those new plants, and I was pretty certain by the time I was a sophomore in high school that I wanted to be a nuclear engineer. Now, I went to the Naval Academy and met some engineering professors who I didn't like, so I decided to be an English major, but I did decide to go back in and get nuclear training later. But anyway.
Getting back to this issue of innovation, I had an interview with a guy from Wired Magazine. This is a high-tech geek magazine. It's almost at the nexus of geekdom in the U.S. And the guy was asking me precisely this question about how innovative is the nuclear industry. He was asking about Generation 2, Generation 3, Generation 4.
Let 1,000 reactors bloom.
Right. It was difficult to get across to him. I finally settled for discussing digital control rooms versus analog control rooms because he's a computer guy, to explain to him how innovation comes in to a mature industry. But he really thought that the Japanese reactors were the standard worldwide, that these things were all 40 years old, would fall over in the first strong wind, and so forth. So it was, I was kind of taken aback by the fact that here's a guy who's technologically smart, adept, follows these things, and yet he had these sort of strange views of the fact that nuclear industry was backwards. So finally I settled for using an analogy of coal and nuclear. I said, you know, let's go to the movies. When King Kong fell off the Empire State Building and landed at 34th Street and 5th Avenue, the New York Sanitation Department suddenly had 1,800 pounds of dead gorilla that they had to remove. On the other hand, Godzilla, who was radioactive, had the good sense to go off to the ocean and die and to leave a mess behind for anybody.
Oh, that's priceless, Dad.
That's good.
Well, you know, there is, unfortunately, and Margaret, you can probably back me up, a bit of sad truth to the perception that all of the nuclear power plants that we're operating today are rather old-fashioned, and many of them, quite honestly, still have some pretty ancient control systems. Yeah. Because it is so hard to go through the process of converting to a digital control system because of the way our regulators regulate.
Yeah, our regulators actually refused to allow digital until about, I want to say about 5 years ago. They said that the industry went to them in the 90s and said, we're having increasingly difficult time replacing these analog control systems that you can't get the parts. We were literally going to factories in Puerto Rico, blowing the dust off the machines and asking them to run them again to generate these analog parts. And so the industry as a whole went to the NRC and said, please, can't we go digital? The FAA is letting pilots go with digital. Can't we please have digital controls? And they said, these aren't airplanes. And refused to allow digital controls until they started to get the DCDs for the design certification documents for the new reactor designs. And we said, we cannot put analog into these systems. We can't buy analog controls. So in reality, the Wired magazine guy is unfortunately somewhat correct in that it is very recent, within the last 5 to 10 years, that we've started to put true digital controls in these control rooms. And the original control rooms look a lot like a coal-fired plant, an old-fashioned coal-fired plant control room, because the first operators came from the coal industry and they wanted the control room to look familiar.
Yep. All right. We've had a wonderful conversation. I'm looking at my clock and realizing that if I don't cut it off, we'll probably have a file that's too big to download. So thank you all for joining me tonight. I hope you have a wonderful week. And I think the news is starting to get better. That's a good thing.
Yeah, they're starting to analyze the water to start to figure out how they're going to decontaminate it. It's good news. We're actually thinking ahead now.
You know, I will make one quick announcement that I've been in touch with a young PhD student from Georgia Tech who's apparently been able to reach out, use Georgia Tech's networks to share a really good idea of how to decontaminate the water using some of the condensate polishing systems that already exist at the plants. And,
cool.
So anyway, there are people out there really thinking, and one of the, like you said, Margaret, we don't have much practice at accidents, so when we do have the opportunity to clean one up, we'll get a lot of learning out of this one worldwide.
You betcha.
And also, don't forget, there have been no fatalities so far.
Don't forget that.
To me, that's the best news of all.
Yep.
I like to remind people of that one, too. Thanks for the reminder, Steve.
It's really a bright spot in the otherwise terrible story of Japan.
It's been rhetorically turned around into, it's more proof that we've got to shut the industry down. It's a very bizarre line of argumentation, but it's out there.
Well, the good thing about it is we're out there, too.
Yep.
All right. Good night, folks.
Good night.
Thanks, Rod.
Thanks, Rod. Bye.
Thanks, you guys. See ya.
Bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.